Roundabout with Tony Barnfield.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded and the struggle is pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
Noel Coward and Mrs. Worthington, better known as Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, recorded by Noel Coward back in 1935. And it was a Noel Coward play Mr. Keller was appearing in at the Arts, A Song at Twilight. He'd just arrived at the theatre for the first night with curtain up not far off as we talked backstage.
You're intrigued by a lot of men, particularly. Anyone from Paul Robeson to Orson Welles, they tend to be quite big men, in a way.
Yeah. Yes, I've always been excited by high-octane personalities. I've always been interested in bigger canvases rather than smaller ones. I'm not by nature a miniaturist, although I admire the art of the miniaturist very much, but it's not one that I really command. Personality has always been a very important factor in my life and my experience. I was very influenced by, is quite the wrong word, I was very stirred by and delighted by my grandmother, that's to say my mother's mother, who was had been a singer in her time and had an extraordinarily warm and generous personality. She wasn't a woman of any great intellectual brilliance, but she was a woman of extraordinary gracefulness and charm and fun and fantasy and... that all of those things were rather lacking, I think, in my life as a child. And so we formed a unit, and so I adored her. But she had a great faith in the idea of personality. She thought personality made the world go round.
Really. And she would have loved the work of Ivor Novello, who's another
person you
admire.
She adored Ivor Novello. And I adore Ivor Novello's work. I think Ivor Novello's music is really of high quality, a remarkable quality. I fear that the vehicles in which most of these songs appeared are almost unrevivably absurd now. But the songs themselves, I think, are full of genuine lyricism and genuine warmth and humanity and tenderness and wonderful lyrical invention.
And he had a most huge following, didn't he?
Enormous. I believe that the attendance at his funeral was only rivaled by that of Churchill, and then by, of course, Princess Diana. But they were the three biggest funerals of the 20th century in England. Amazingly enough, and it was because there's an extraordinary sweetness and genuine romanticism about his work. Sentimental also, but romantic at core. Not for nothing was he inspired by The Merry Widow, you know, the show that he saw 20 times in a row.
That's Lehar, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yearn in a way for yesteryear?
No, I don't really. I'm not sentimental about the past really very much, but I do regret the performers and in some ways the form of theatre that might have existed in those days. I suppose certain words that very much attach themselves to both Coward and Novello, like glamour and a certain kind of theatrical magic or whatever, and especially, of course, the magic of the personalities. And I was lucky enough to see a lot of very great actors in my childhood and youth, the famous generation of Olivier and Gielgud and Richardson and Peggy Ashcroft and Edith Evans and all these people I saw. And they pervade something which I don't think you see on the stage anymore. I think it's probably something which has disappeared from life in general.
It's almost class, isn't it? But not in the class structure, just that...
Classiness? Not quite the way I'd put it. I think it's to do with... I think they just believed in the idea of developing. They had a very, very strong awareness of the force of personality. And that was what people went to the theatre for, to see extraordinary people. And I think what happened in probably the 50s and then increasingly took over was the idea that what people wanted to see on stage were ordinary people. In other words, themselves or real life or whatever. And the idea of that generation, probably all previous generations, had been to show something exotic and extraordinary and exceptional. I always like to put it this way, that it's rather like going to the zoo. You go to the zoo to see extraordinary and remarkable and exceptional creatures that are very different from you, although they may remind you at a certain point of your Uncle George. That I think, was really why people went to the theatre, to be taken out of themselves rather than to be brought to themselves, although that also was not disqualified. I mean, obviously, Olivier, for example, in creating Richard III, shall we say, as he did it, embodied all of our worst nightmares about evil uncles and ruthless tyrants, but in an extraordinarily vivid and highly coloured way. That naturally appeals to me, yes.
I do remember me. Henry VI did prophesy that Richmond should be king when Richmond was a little peevish boy. A king, perhaps.
My lord.
How chance the prophet could not have told me, I being by, that I should kill him.
My lord, your promise for the earldom.
Richmond. A bard of Ireland told me once I should not live long after I saw Richmond.
My lord.
Aye. What's o'clock?
I am thus bold to put your grace in mind of what you promised me.
Well, but what's o'clock?
Upon the stroke of 10.
Then let it strike!
Why? Let it strike.
Because that, like a jack, thou keep'st the stroke betwixt thy begging and my meditation. Is thy name Tyrrell?
James Tyrrell, and your most obedient subject.
Art thou indeed?
Prove me, my gracious lord.
I'm not in the giving vein today.
Why? Then resolve me whether you will or no.
Thou troublest me. I'm not in the vein.
You famously wrote to Sir Laurence Olivier, as he then was, when he was running the National Theatre, I imagine, at the Old Vic.
Yes, he was at the Old Vic. And it was because I'd seen so many shows at the Old Vic in his regime. And, of course, I was very thrilled by the shows. They are now legendary shows from that early period of his, the Uncle Vanya and the Othello and all that kind of stuff. It was absolutely fantastic. But it wasn't that I wrote to him about. What I was excited about was the fact that everybody who worked in that theatre seemed to be passionate about working there. The box office, the people in the coffee bar, the people who were running the bookshop, and I imagined all the people backstage whom one didn't see, like stage managers and so on. No, I knew nothing about the theatre as such, but I thought that must be the case. And I just wrote and said to him, I explained to him in a 3 full scat page, closely typed letter, what an excellent theatre he was running, and he wrote back pretty well by return of post and said, if you like it so much, why don't you come and work it? We have a job in the box office.
Did you?
Oh, yes, that's what
I did.
Ladies
and gentlemen, the Stock Dweller Company, if you'd gather, please, in the green room.
So, box office to star, do you see yourself as? Because you write almost as much as you act.
Yes, and I direct a lot as well, and I've done a lot of everything, really, one way or another. No, I wouldn't describe myself as a star at all. I'm extremely recognisable and well-known, and people have... I'm a sort of a particular commodity that people recognise and seem, on the whole, to be rather nice about. But the sort of stardom that... Well, certainly the sort of stardom that we're talking about with, in the case of Carden, and Olivia and so on. No, I don't think I have that at all. But as I say, it's less of a feature of our world. But of course, I don't have the star following of of people who've become very famous on television or very famous on film.
Because, of course, there are so many people acting today, yes. So much television and so on.
Yes.
And in a way, it keeps the theatres going.
Yes, quite clear, and so it should, and it always has done. Olivier was, of course, a film star, huge. Gielgud, much less so, of course, until late in his career, but Michael Redgrave was a film star. Peggy Ashcroft wasn't really a film star at all. Judi Dench wasn't a film star until very late in her career. So it varies, but yes, of course, that's exactly the way it should be. And most actors who act in film, most actors have experience in the theatre, and most of them love to come back to the theatre because it's where you meet your audience, and if you don't meet your audience, then you begin to forget why you're doing it.
You're in, if I can be so rude, your 70th year at the moment, heading towards actually becoming 70. What more do you... Is there anything different you want to achieve, or is it just more of the best?
Oh, God, no, there's so much that I want to do that I haven't done. But the most important thing is to write a novel, or maybe several novels. I've been planning to do that and wanting to do that, never taken the time to really just sit down and do it, but I really, really would like to do that very much. And I've made sort of a curious career as a one-man performer, and it fascinates me, and it continues to fascinate me. It's storytelling more than anything else that fascinates me. And I think the one-man or the one-person show is a very pure form of that, and I've just done my fifth season of Christmas Carol as a one-man show in London, and I think in this last revival we've achieved as much as we and all of us dreamt we could. I think it was a fine piece of theatre, but even more exciting for me is that we filmed not the stage show, but we filmed the Christmas Carol as a one-man show, and it was shown on television, and I think it's a really wonderful film. I also am very keen to go back to directing films. I directed one film quite a long time ago, which was a very, very, very difficult experience. It was starring Vanessa Redgrave and Rod Steiger and Keith Carradine and an alcoholic dwarf. It was not a happy experience. And I'd like to come back and have another go.
Well, to refer to what you said just now, you've certainly had a Dickens of a life. Simon Callow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.
Red for the flames in fury. Black. Yellow and red. Black for the mourning ashes. Black, yellow and red. And yellow of gold as we proudly hail the spirits of the dead. To the flag, my sons, your country with her blessing. Forward cries. Has it shrunken? No, when smallest, larger, statelier it flies. Is it tattered? No, 'tis stoutest when destruction it defies.
Simon Callow, the speaker there, Le Drapeau Belge, the Belgian flag, from a CD called The Longed For Light, containing unusual pieces of music, that one written in 1916 by Sir Edward Elgar, during, of course, the First World War, and premiered at the Queen's Hall on the 14th of April the following year. And it was John Wilson there conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra.